just a baby. Before I could speak, I would line up all my letter blocks alphabetically. Now it's my vocation and my passion to assign every decimal numbered shelf to every decimal numbered spine. I'm
Sagal with the Library Show, and my guest today is Cassidy Patineau. Hey, Cassidy.
Hello.
So, did you bring some books to talk about?
I brought a book to talk about, but I brought some ideas to talk about as well. If you might want to lean a little more in. Yeah, there you go. I was getting low levels from you. I don't know if I'm solved that now, but I brought in The Revenant by Michael Punky. Where is that?
And I saw the movie last night, but I'm going to ask you anyway, what is that book about?
It's essentially like this revenge story from, I don't know, way back in the day about a fur trapper who is injured by a bear and his companions abandon him. But they don't just abandon him, they take all of his stuff before he dies. They take his gun and his knife and kind of anything of value that he has, and they just leave him out there instead of waiting for him to die and burying him. So he interprets this as they're essentially trying to have murdered him. Then he stalks them across the American West and tries to kill them back.
And did you have some favorite parts to that book or things that you thought about and observed?
The thing that I liked the most about it was it's a very, honestly, a fairly slow-paced story. Not a lot happens exactly. Like, there's not a ton of individual events, but there's a lot of sort of musing where he's just sort of getting by, building up little traps to catch mice to eat and just struggling to survive. And I thought that what the author did a pretty good job of, at least I thought he captured the idea that we were living in a very, very unpleasant, it wasn't easy to live back. And I think we have a lot of this sort of, I don't know how to phrase it exactly. We kind of romanticize the West and these simpler times and have this idea that somehow everything was great back in the day because people didn't deal with, you know, all these complications. And this book does a really good job of showing that it was probably, to our, like, kind of soft living standards, a terrible time to live.
Did you get any ideas of how you might survive if you were in a similar situation, how you might catch mice?
He described the traps that he used pretty well. Essentially what he did was a bottle trap where you dig a hole that has that's wider at the bottom than the top, so it's kind of like shaped like a wine bottle. And as little mice or whatever get down in there, it's kind of like a crab trap. They can get in, but they can't get back out. And so then in the morning, you just, you know, mash them up with a stick and then pull them out. And, I mean, he spends a good amount of time describing skinning the little mice with his shaving razor. They're like one of the only things he had with him. And, I mean, the main thing I think I learned from reading it is that if I were put in that situation, I would die.
Yes, very clearly I would die too. I have not read the book. I was invited to go to the movie, and it's normally a movie I would refuse to go to. I don't like to especially watch violence. But knowing that you had read the book and that we would be talking about it, I went to the movie last night, and they didn't catch mice in the movie, but one thing I did notice is he creates a little fish weir to try to catch some fish. And I looked at it and thought, oh, you know, that makes sense. I could make a little fish weir like that and catch live fish and begin to gobble it like Gollum and, you know, get some sustenance.
Right. Well, and it's kind of nice to look at to see some of those things put to action. And one of the classes I taught last session was a survival class, and it was looking at technical writing through the lens of survival literature. And we read Beresford Angier's How to Stay Alive in the Woods. And there's a lot of descriptions and pictures of how to build those kind of traps. And really, I guess the book actually did a good job, too, of demonstrating how much easier trapping is than hunting, especially when you're not in, you know, perfect situation and just step off your boat and, you know, had a great breakfast. You know, but if you're hungry and weak and tired, you can expend a lot of energy trying to find food, whereas if you set a trap, it just waits and finds the food for you, essentially.
I wonder if people have actually survived in the wilderness because of books they've read or ideas that they've had shown to them in movies. I know that I like to read a lot of books about survival at the sea, and in one book, the sailors have been on a little life raft for a very long time, and it has a hole, so somebody has to go over the side and repair. Well, when they go underneath the boat, they find goose barnacles, and it provides a whole meal or several meals for these men who are starving on the boat. And now I know that if I'm ever in that situation, I'm going to be looking for goose barnacles.
Yeah, I'd imagine that there's some. I think that, for me anyway, more important than, you know, thing. I mean, goose barnacles is a good example, or, you know, some of those little examples they pop up here and there in novels might be helpful. But I think that what really would be useful for me to have, having read this book, if I was put in the woods, I would try to channel that will to survive more than, I think, giving up would probably be my number one. If I was injured and didn't know how to find food, I think the despair of that would probably be what really, you know, brought me down. But if I had kind of to try to empathize and identify with a character that survived, that might be something that could drive me forward.
And is it revenge? Is that what's fueling his survival in the book?
I would say functionally, yes. It's one of those things where in reading it and in watching TV and all sorts of things, I always wonder why people do what they do. I wonder why I do the things that I do. Like, what am I trying to get? And as far as I can tell, it's revenge for him.
Now, have you seen the movie?
No, I've seen a couple of little parts of it online. It looked like they've changed a lot in terms of, and I imagine they would because so much of the book is internal dialogue.
Yeah, and I think they give him a stronger reason for revenge. And I don't think it's giving anything away for those who haven't seen the movie in to say that in the movie, his son is killed in front of his eyes by the people who abandoned him. So he has a very strong reason for revenge in the movie. But it's harder to see that internal dialogue about his feelings about revenge in the movie because he's every step of the way trying just to survive. A couple of times he scrawls a message on the snow or the rocks, and you realize that's sort of his internal dialogue coming out.
Yeah, and a lot of the book, I mean, you know, I know that he's heading to catch these people and catch up with them, but ultimately so much of it's focused on just his trying to survive. You know, when he has a quiet introspective moment, that's when that, you know, cold revenge mindset comes back up, and that at times is probably what is driving him forward. But a lot of it's just like, well, if I don't eat, I'll die. So here's where I'm going to spend all my time. And so you get a lot of this dialogue in his head, a lot about just, it's not even, well, what should I do? It's, okay, now I'm going to build this, and now I'm going to crawl here, and now I'm going to be afraid of that. It's a pretty action-packed novel. It seems, you know, improbable, but then occasionally you do read accounts of people who have survived through these great kind of travails. And I'm like, well, you know, at least I was able to suspend my disbelief throughout, and so I found it pretty enjoyable.
You needed to do that in the movie, too. Incredibly violent. If you don't like violent movies, do not go to this one. But very beautifully filmed with great big swaths of scenery. So you might want to go. But I felt like I was trapped in a Cormac McCarthy novel watching the movie. It seemed very bleak and violent and desperate and hopeless. So The Revenant. And again, I'm here with Cassidy Patno. Cassidy, we were going to talk about some things other than books on this show. And
sure.
You're a gamer, and we thought we'd talk a little bit about reading and games. And I'm going to share, I think my parents are listening to this in Iowa. That's where they're living right now. In the early 80s, I believe it was my father, brought home a TI-99. And it's a computer, did not have a monitor. You'd hook it up to a television. The programs came on audio cassettes, which you then loaded, and it was all text-based. There were no graphics at all. You just read words on the screen, and you responded. And it would the game that I remember playing, I believe it was called Pirate Adventure, and the whole point of the game was to crawl through many, many, many rooms and gather items. And the only item I remember was water wings, and that helped me identify the game we're playing. I loved that game. And then it went to graphics, and graphics were slow back then that I totally turned off video games. But I think you had a different experience with video games.
Yeah, I grew up a little later, and I kind of cut my teeth early on the original Nintendo Entertainment System, the NES, which came out, I think it actually came out the year I was born. So it was a little bit old by the time I got my hands on one. But those were quick and fast and kind of arcadey. But I always really liked computers, and I would just kind of just dredge the thrift store looking for we didn't have the money to buy a new computer because they were quite expensive. I don't think I got one until I was in late middle school. That I would go and find some old strange cast off. I think we got a Commodore 64 once from.
We had one, I think, too, when I was young.
Yeah, and that was another one of those. The monitor from that is like, if I ever see the dedicated Commodore monitor, it's probably one of the most tangible objects where I'm like, childhood, because it had a RCA RCA inputs on the front, so I could plug anything into
yes.
it.
Yes.
So that was a fun little thing. But text adventures back in the day, I really liked. I mean, I remember. In first and second grade, even playing through the Zork series and having no chance of being successful. Like, it's a pretty high reading level, or at least it takes a lot of dedication to figure it out. But I liked the interactive aspect of it. I loved reading forever, and that was like reading, and I could tell it what to do.
And to someone who's never used one of these text-based games, you'd be given maybe a paragraph that says, you're entering a room, around you see something gleaming on the floor, and you had in Pirate Adventure, you could use two words, a verb and an object, and you might say, take ring, take object. And that would be the key to enable you to go to the next room or open something. But it was a very limited vocabulary, very limited number of things you could do, and I loved it.
I remember I actually taught Zork. I did a video games as lit class last year, and that was fun because we looked at a lot of those older kind of text-based games or sort of puzzle games. Zork is a little bit more intuitive than that. You can do fairly complex sentences, so, you know, pick up the purple ring as opposed, and it will get, if there's two rings, it'll take the, you know, the actual adjectives matter. Whereas if you just said pick up ring, it would ask you, well, which ring do you mean? But if there's only one ring in the room, it would pick it up.
So a little more advanced than the game I was playing.
Yeah, and I think that was helpful as a kid. I remember, like, figuring out how to parse the text, and it didn't do well with spelling errors. It couldn't, that just meant you were wrong. So having to kind of work my way through you're boxing with the syntax a little bit, but it was pretty intuitive. That was nice to be able to take part in the story and, you know, fail along with it, as opposed to just following the thread that the author gave me.
So let's flash forward from your middle school days to the present. What text-based or reading-based games are you involved with now?
I haven't played a lot of text-based games anymore. Graphics are such king at the moment, but there's a lot of games out there now that are very story-centric, and especially I've been playing The Witcher 3, which I think ended up on the library show's webpage or Facebook page recently.
Yeah, I posted.
And it's based off of a book series about, it's a fantasy series that has a sort of, I would say, Eastern European mythology to it, as opposed to the more kind of Tolkien-esque English fantasy. So it's a little bit more dreary and bleak, and I feel like there's a lot less black and white morality. It's kind of like everything's a shade of gray, and the good guys are bad guys, and the bad guys are all right. You know, and it's kind of this weird, you don't know who to actually empathize with. But the game itself has an incredibly in-depth amount of background knowledge that they've scrubbed out of the books, and some of that's delivered through the actual gameplay and the story, and you have meaningful conversations with characters where you choose what to say out of a list of options. You don't type it in. But there's also, I would guess, hundreds of pages of background information that you can access.
That would stop in the middle of the game and actually read, or would you do it before you played the game?
I would stop in the middle, typically, and that ranges from, you know, if you're fighting monsters, you can go and look, essentially, your character keeps, like, a diary or a journal of how to fight certain monsters, like, oh, this type of, you know, they're weak to silver, and it's, you know, or, you know, they're born out of the spurned lover who drowned in a swamp.
So you kind of develop your own cheats.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not, and they give it to you, they update it for you, which is nice, but it'll tell you when those journals have been updated. There's a huge character list, and as you find out more about characters in the storyline, it starts to add to their little biography in the game, which is really nice, because I'm like, who was that? You know, especially if I don't get to play games as much as I'd like, because I have a job. So if I go a week or two, it can be hard to jump back in, but it's nice to have that kind of background information that goes stretches from before the game's timeline started to through things that you're doing. So it really feels like you're uncovering the information.
Does the game give you artifacts, like you press on something and you have a map?
Yeah, there's a map most of the time. There's an entire section in your inventory dedicated to in-game writing, so you can read little sections of books from the game universe that don't have necessarily any impact on the game. They're just background information. So if you really enjoy just looking at kind of the set dressing and figuring out, like, oh, this is the setting of the game, this is why the characters talk the way they do and interact the way they do, there's a lot of information, everything from, you know, there's histories that, you know, from antiquity in the game world to modern, you know, like joke books that are set in the game world. So you can just find laying around on people's shelves or go to libraries or things.
One thing that I remember when I was trying to figure out which game it was I had played, and my only clue was it was text-based and it had water wings in it. I started to do research, and what clued in that this, I found the right game, it's Pirate Adventure, is it was a map that was available that someone had mapped all the rooms. And I remember doing that when I played the game, is creating, getting a piece of paper and mapping the rooms and creating what you described, but having it in paper and pencil rather than available to me online.
Right. And I mean, as much as I kind of pine for and have nostalgia for those old games like Zork or Pirate Adventure, in the real modern world of my life, I absolutely don't have the time to sit down with graph paper and make
maps.
The maps. I mean, and I used to as a kid. I remember having a binder, a graph paper binder with maps for the old Zelda games or the King's Quest series by Sierra, which were more of an they're a graphical adventure title, but it's sort of solve the puzzle to unfold more of the story.
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
These new modern games, which I don't play because I got turned off the graphics a very long time ago, but do you actually create the story as you go through it? Do you get to create the story, or is it just something that you have to uncover?
It really depends on the game. I mean, there's a pretty stark. I mean, there's so many different games. The gaming industry is huge at this point. And there's games, everything from, you know, that is essentially, I think of them as rail shooters, because you're, like, on rails. You don't really have a whole lot of control. It's like, if you don't go down the right hallway, the game just doesn't progress.
Mm-hmm.
Through things that are just, here's everything that the game has to offer, and you uncover it at your own pace. Games in which you write your own narrative are pretty uncommon. There's one I played recently, and I think it's an indie game called Eulogy for a Dead World, in which you're essentially playing a space anthropologist, and you fly from world to world and find these sort of like monuments of lost civilizations, and you need to come up with your own interpretation. There's no end point in which you win, though. It's just getting the opportunity to like muse about these sort of beautiful scenery and set pieces. Games are a little, I mean, much like books, what's in the book is there. You can do outside research and kind of write your own, you know, fan fiction, but actually inserting it into the game can be challenging.
I guess a game could be big enough that you could never know all the games, so it could feel like you had free will when you go this way rather than that way.
Yeah, and especially if you're a player who's not focused on just following the... Usually the most games that have a main narrative have, you know, you can just follow that quest line, essentially. Okay, well, I'm going to go here, I'm going to fight this dragon, I'm going to take these bones to the king to prove to him that I'm worthy to, you know, and just so on. And you just follow that thread till the end of the game. But they also have huge amounts of just side quests where it'll be like, you know, on your way to go fight the dragon, someone on the side of this, you know, road is, they're laying there injured, and you decide, like, I'm going to stop and help them. But you don't have to. In my opinion, the best games don't really reward or punish you for your moral choices. Like, they let the way they explain the narrative of those things folding out punish you or reward you. So, you know, if you stop and help the person, then later on someone you find them again later on and they thank you. And that's like, oh, that's a nice feeling. Or like you know, find somebody later on has posted a missing notice looking for that individual. And you're like, ugh, I could have helped, but I didn't.
Well, I'm going to go on a little side adventure right now and ask you about something else.
Sure.
I recently at Blatchley got a call for copies of The Hobbit to take to Pacific High, and I learned that they were actually for you and your class.
Yeah.
So maybe you could tell what you're doing with The Hobbit.
At the beginning, after winter break, Pacific High has a 2-week section called PHS, or J. We call it J session, January session. And the morning of that is always PHS Reads. So each of the three main teachers there picks a book or a selection of writings, and then you basically teach a little lit class. So I picked The Hobbit because I recently discovered or came to the conclusion that Bilbo Baggins is the only character that I've ever been like, that's someone that I can actually like look up to. That's my hero, because I've never had a good answer when people are like, who's your hero? I'm like, I don't know, nobody. And then people criticize you. So now
you have Bilbo Baggins as your hero. And why is he your hero?
I think because he is, you know, he's a little bookish. He likes to learn. He's like, and just likes the idea of knowledge, and also is just very much into comfort. You know, his day-to-day life is, and there's a reoccurring theme in the Hobbit is him thinking about being back at home where things are easy.
As his pipe, he has some mushroom pie. He's sitting in front of the fire.
Yeah, exactly.
And life's good.
And then he has to go on this adventure, and he doesn't say no. He kind of, vacillates a little bit or waffles on it, but then ends up going, and he sees it through when once he's out there. He never actually even tries to turn back. And I definitely can identify with that on, like, the adventures I've had where it's hard to get that initial, like, overcome the inertia of just staying on the couch and, you know, enjoying a book and looking at a map. But there's a difference, you know, when you actually challenge yourself to go out there. And when I'm sleeping on a rock at the middle of the night, I'm like, okay, I wish I was at home right now, but this is cool. So
are your students, are they universally familiar with the book before you bring it to them?
I only think one of them had read the book.
But they've seen the movie?
A lot of them have seen the movies, and I really like, I mean, I've only saw the first movie. I didn't see the second and third one because I was very angry after the first movie. I really like that they already have the wherewithal while reading on the fly to kind of point out and say, this isn't how it happened in the movie. Like, this is different. Or, hey, isn't this the part when we're, aren't we about to? And they can really, like, lead up to those moments in their heads. And that kind of comparative thinking is something that I think a lot of us take for granted, but is actually fairly challenging to make meaningful. Not just to say, well, in the movie he said hi, and in the book he said hello. But, I mean, actually looking at the difference between, you know, the way that characters make choices. And, well, there's no love story in the book. It's just these, you know, 13 little men and, you know, that. So.
But maybe there's a love story there.
Yeah. I mean, there's a love story of, you know, platonic camaraderie that we see. I mean, it's very, I didn't know, and I might be wrong, and I'm sure some Tolkien fan is going to be angry with this, but I read that he originally wrote The Hobbit as a story for his own children or his own grandchildren.
I believe that's true.
And so in reading it, knowing that, and I'm reading it aloud primarily with the group, it's you can tell that it's a book written to be told as a story like that, as opposed to Lord of the Rings, which is so grandiose.
Now, The Hobbit is one of the reasons I can explain like why I like books and stories. We're sitting here talking about a movie sharing with your students a book that has a movie adaptation. And I visited New Zealand 5 years ago, and was so excited when I was there to visit Hobbiton, thinking there would be only these concrete forms left over from the Lord of the Rings set. But when we got to the place to buy the tickets, we had to sign a disclosure agreement. And my excitement just grew and grew because I realized that something was up. When we get on the bus and get taken out to the place where the set was, and they're building the new set for the movie, and we had a guide taking us around, telling us about the set, and it just, this link that I'm there, this guy is telling the story of the production of a movie, of a novel written by this guy who used sources going back as far as Beowulf. So you can start like with Beowulf and move forward, and then we're here today, and it's all, the story's just all connected.
Right, and I've actually, it's been fun looking at the, you know, because I like to bird walk, get out on tangents. We spent time looking at The Hobbit with the students, where I've pulled up and said, you know, Tolkien was steeped in language and steeped in this sort of like, you know, Anglo-centric view of the history of literature. And so, you know, Beowulf and those, and the riddles and all these things are all kind of come out of these, you know, or aspects of that are in The Hobbit, these old English sort of aspects that he mixes into the narrative, and everyone likes them because they say it feels like it's old. It feels like it gives it some like gravitas. But we've gotten to like listen to some old English spoken or looked at it and said, and I had the kids do a little rune translation and say, okay, now imagine translating this into a language that you barely speak or don't speak at all. And that was a fun, it's been a fun time to actually like break down how complicated, like it's a simple story that has a lot to offer.
Yes.
I should probably play this message from our community. It's a little thing, so I'm going to run that, and we'll be back in like 30 seconds.
Sounds good.
The Sicka Sound Slayers Roller Derby League is getting ready to compete in the Alaska State Tournament, but we need your help to get there. Come cheer on the Slayers on January 16th. All ticket sales will help bring the team up to Palmer to compete for the number one spot in the state. Tickets are on sale for $10 at Old Harbor Books or ask your favorite skater. For more information, visit www.sickasoundslayers.com.
All right, well, so just to kind of continue the thought, there's a lot that you can do, I think, interpretive around. I mean, this is me trying to tie everything we've talked about together, and the idea that there's more than just the narrative, and we have the opportunity to know only, you know, through research, through our own production, writing fan fiction, or just, you know, laying around and imagining things about, you know, the universes we love. I mean, how many little kids are out there playing Harry Potter and adding their own stories to that canon? That's, I mean, I think that that's a really excellent part of...
Well, one thing I've enjoyed reading lately is the fan theories about The Force Awakens when I just flip through browse on the internet. And one thing I've noticed is people are writing. So they're writing out their theories and sharing, and then people respond. And in the past, it would have just been a reviewer reviewing the movie, and now people are getting involved. And I read another article that was very interesting. It was about how Sherlock Holmes began the whole fan fiction fan involvement in fiction when Conan Doyle killed off Sherlock Holmes. People were outraged and he got death threats, and it was because fans wanted it that Sherlock Holmes came back. He was a revenant of some sort himself.
I heard a similar thing about Pinocchio, which was like originally written as a serialized, like it was coming out in newspapers. I mean, it was like a little side column, and it was at some point Pinocchio died, and fans were just livid. And so they had to get to, you know, kind of, yeah, revenant him. Although I think a tale of revenge for Pinocchio and Sherlock Holmes would be something I could definitely see. Oh, with a nice Danny Elfman soundtrack. And yeah, but I like that sort of the push that people can make towards changing the narrative as a whole. And, you know, even the idea of that idea of fan service where, you know, they're going to add something or create something specifically because they know the fans will like it or want it. It's a really interesting kind of back and forth play with authors and audience. So I like that idea.
Yeah, it makes it fun. Anything else you'd like to add?
I don't have a whole lot overall. I mean, I definitely would recommend reading The Revenant. If you like the kind of book that just sort of drops, just drops you off without a whole lot of context. My favorite novels, I realized as I read The Revenant, are always that way. It's like those books that, and I'm thinking right now of like cyberpunk Bruce Sterling, you know, kind of things where they just, okay, now you go and you don't get explained what a, you know, T-25E is. The character just uses it, and through the context of it or through descriptions of it that aren't, hey, reader, take a moment, let me tell you about this thing that everyone else in this world knows about. They describe it in a way that would make sense for someone who actually lived in that world. You know, I wouldn't stop and say, a computer is a device that allows you to look for information. And, you know, I would just say, like, I turned on the monitor, you know, and look at the hazy screen as I type on the, you know, like, and you have to figure it out through contextual clues. The Revenant's very much like that. It doesn't spend a lot of time kind of giving you too much context. It just gives you enough, you know. It'll tell you why his gun is special, not why guns are useful. And I think that that's like a meaningful difference. So
how much time do we have left?
We have 40 seconds.
Okay. Carrie Sagal, KCAW Radio, Raven Radio, here with Cassidy Patno, my guest on the Library Show. In future episodes, J.R. Anchetta, Bill the Giant, and then a special campfire edition where the hosts sit around the campfire and talk about scary books. Anything else you'd like to say?
Nope. Grab a book. Make time to read. You know, force yourself to do it because it's easy to get out of the habit, and my life is always improved when I make sure that I have time to read.
Okay. So. Well, thank you, Cassidy.
Yeah, thanks for having me.